The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
History was just made a short time ago in our nation's capital, the impeachment of a president advancing to the Senate. For only the third time in history, the president will now face a Senate trial.
The U.S. and China have signed a partial trade deal aimed at easing the 18-month trade conflict between the world's two biggest economies. President Trump and China's vice premier attended a ceremony at the White House. And Mr. Trump said the agreement was a momentous step towards a future of fair and reciprocal trade between the U.S. and China.
Once President Trump said all is well, the market faded geopolitical risk. I think right now they're focusing on what the supply picture looks like, what is OPEC going to do. I mean, the trade war, that's still a little bit in the ether. You know, it wasn't as fulsome an agreement as people maybe were expecting.
December housing starts jumped nearly 17% for the month, and we're about 41% higher annually, the highest level since December 2006.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Another record-breaking week for the market. We finally got a trade deal that was signed on Wednesday as markets head higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining us on the program today will be Bullseye Craig Johnson. As last week, we covered the average gains for the market this year, somewhere around 3,400 for the S&P. Craig Johnson thinks it's going to 3,600. You're going to want to listen to why he thinks that's going to be the case. And Mike McClone from Bloomberg is going to be on the program. He loves gold, and he thinks this is a good year for the price of the precious metal. And of course, Chris Sheridan and myself will be talking about the big picture, our own view of what happens in 2020. All of that coming up.
U.S. stocks rose Friday to fresh record highs, capping off a strong week for equities on the heels of strong economic data and corporate earnings results. The S&P 500 was up nearly 2% for the week, the Dow rose 1.8%, and the NASDAQ climbed 2.3% for this week. The S&P 500 closed at 3,329, the Dow at 29,348, the NASDAQ at 9,388. Crude oil closed this week at $58.68 a barrel, and gold at $1,557 an ounce. A year and a half after launching a trade war against China, President Trump signed the Phase 1 trade deal on Wednesday. Some of the main details on this include an agreement by the Chinese to purchase an additional $200 billion in U.S. goods over the next 2 years, including everything from industrial equipment, agricultural products like soybeans and meat, LNG, oil, and even services like data hosting, cloud computing, and others. As a symbol of the renewed exchange of love between the U.S. and China, the deal will take effect on Valentine's Day next month, on February 14th. Citing comments by a number of trade groups on Thursday, day after the trade deal was signed, CNBC reported that U.S. business leaders don't see the Phase 1 trade deal as a huge breakthrough, mostly because the tariffs that were originally put in place are still in effect, but they're really just glad it's not getting any worse and are still hoping for an actual reduction of existing tariffs in a Phase 2 deal down the road. On the economic front, U.S. housing starts surged 16.9% last month, well above expectations, to a 13-year high. This is boosting confidence in the housing market and further bolstering the narrative that U.S. housing, which had seen a bit of a slowdown over the past year and a half or so, will now be providing an important tailwind to U.S. economic growth for 2020. This Thursday, Google's parent company Alphabet topped a $1 trillion valuation for the first time ever. It now joins two other U.S. tech behemoths, Apple and Microsoft, with a 13-digit market cap. That's a 1 followed by 12 zeros, just in case you were wondering. Amazon did get to $1 trillion intraday in the summer of 2018, but has been lagging behind Google, Apple, and Microsoft since. Those are your market headlines for the week. In part two of our interview with Martin Armstrong to discuss his latest book, Manipulating the World Economy, The Rise of Modern Monetary Theory, and the Inevitable Fall of Classical Economics, Martin Armstrong tells listeners how he believes modern monetary theory, which is the last hurrah or last ditch attempt by government to control the economy, is going to eventually lead to, as we've seen time and time again throughout history, to a tax revolt and perhaps another American Revolution. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners.
They say, see, look, governments have increased the amount of money spending and it doesn't produce inflation. So their theory is that, one, just keep raising taxes on the rich and then print whatever we need to create whatever programs they have in their mind. And it shouldn't be inflationary. And it's just preposterous because what they don't understand is really the human response to a lot of this. It's always a tax revolt. Government abuses its position, extorts the people, and once you basically reduce the people's ability to survive, then they get off their couches, they're not going to watch the TV, and then they're going to come out.
We covered a lot of material in this recent interview with Martin Armstrong on his new book, including healthcare reform, socialism, taxation, modern monetary theory, what governments are planning with cryptocurrencies, and much, much more. So if you want to listen to this wide-ranging interview with the legendary forecaster and strategist Martin Armstrong, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
Did you know that municipal bonds can provide you with a predictable source of income that is free from both federal and state income taxes? If you're in a high tax bracket, municipal bonds could be the right investment choice for you. If you have more than $500,000 to invest, our portfolio managers can create a municipal bond portfolio designed to align with your financial goals. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939 now and add tax-free bonds to your portfolio. That's 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, if you're an investor, you had to be very happy with the results of 2019, and here we are in 2020, with the uptrend in the markets continuing as one record after another continues on Wall Street. In fact, it only took about 40 days for the Dow to gain about 1,000 points. Will this trend continue? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Bullseye Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. And Craig, I wanted to talk to you because last week we did our 2020 forecast for the year with Wall Street and the consensus. Most strategists are seeing 3,400 on the S&P this year. You're at the top of the list with 3,600. So let's get into that. What is driving your thoughts on a 3,600 S&P?
Thanks, Jim, and thanks for having me back on the program. One thing I just want to update you and all the listeners on is the acquisition between Piper and Sandler O'Neill has been completed, and we have been rebranded Piper Sandler for all the listeners out there. So they've heard Piper Jaffray for years, but it's now Piper Sandler.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so diving into the how we get to our 3,600 objective on the S&P 500, Jim, is the same methodology that we've been doing for over a decade. And what we've historically done is we've looked at every single name in the Dow and where we think that those names in the Dow can actually move up to based upon technical analysis. And once we do that, we will then sum up all of those stocks' price objectives of where we think they can go to, and then we will divide it out by the Dow divisor. We'll take a ratio of that to get to an S&P 500 price target. And Jim, as simple as that may sound, it's actually done a pretty good job, and you know, humbly, it has earned us the Bullseye Johnson label from you, and certainly appreciate that. What we've done this year is the same as we've always done, which is, again, looked at price first, without trying to get bogged down in all of the geopolitical concerns and bogged down into all the other challenges that are out there, and just simply let the market tell us where it is priced to go to.
Now, in your market observations, arriving at that 3,600, you talk about The Fed backstop with a positive sloping yield curve, that's probably got to be favorable for financials. A rotation from safe haven into risk assets, which we're seeing now. And you're basically saying, look, we see this glass as half full. Let me ask you this, Greg. In my lifetime, and certainly in yours, we've never seen a bull market, or for that matter, an economic recovery that has lasted as long as this one. So when you're coming to something that is this long, normally people start to get cautious. I'm not seeing that from you.
No, because stocks are not telling us that this bull run is over. And Jim, I'd also just add, there's a little bit of debate to when this bull market started. And what I mean by that is at the bottom of the, at March of 2009, everybody, all investors were under their desks. Nobody had any idea that was the start of one of the longest secular bull markets in history. It wasn't until you finally broke out above that 2000 and 2007 highs that you could say, hey, we started something new and broke out. So from a technical perspective, I would argue that this bull market really started in 2013 when you finally cleared that 1550 versus 2009. So yeah, it's been a lengthy move up, but stocks are telling us that this move is not yet done.
Now, in addition to be a market technician, you're also a CFA. I want to talk about some of your macro thoughts that are also supporting this. Let's begin with the U.S. economy. You see the economy growing at roughly about 2% for the year, being driven by, as you're talking about, companies are hiring, consumers are spending. You've got a robust labor market, accommodative monetary policy, stable housing market. And as I see it, one of the big drivers, even though business investment hasn't been as robust, it is consumer spending and government spending.
And an unemployment rate at about 3.5%. That seems like it's staying there. So Jim, when you put it all together and you put this all and you look at all these different pieces, the economy is doing okay. It's not running too hot. You've got some deflationary trends continue to come into play, whether it's going to be, you know, new forms of technology that are continuing to lower costs for consumers or making more efficient delivery, or whether it's allowing people to be more productive. We can think of all the different apps that have led to these lower costs. So you're not getting the big inflationary pressures, but yet people are still going through the formation of buying homes, having children. None of those trends have ultimately changed. So the economy is doing okay. The unemployment rate is low, and we are seeing some wage growth, not as much as I would like to see, but putting it all together, things are pretty okay. And what has been moving this market, though, has been an accommodative Fed. And they continue to be kind of a backstop for equities. And you've seen most of the central banks, in fact, around the world being, you know, cutting and reducing and providing more liquidity to the markets. So all those pieces come together, Jim, are very constructive. And then structurally, we need to think about this market has shrunk over time. Since 2000, we've got 25% fewer stocks today than we had in 2000. So an okay economy, liquidity coming in from the central banks and a shrinking market, stocks have to continue to keep kind of working their way higher. And I think that's part of the reason, too, that this has been a bull market that's lasted as long as it has.
I want to talk about some of the differences that we're seeing. This began in the fourth quarter, Craig. Up until roughly about September, you had maybe four sectors within the S&P doing well. Three of them were on the safety or the income side. It was consumer staples, it was REITs, it was utilities plus technology. After September, that changed. As I look at the S&P sectors outside of maybe REITs right now, and even REITs are coming back, just about every sector across the board is doing well. What does that tell you?
Jim, for most of 2019, and why we had a market that was challenging for investors, to put it nicely, was people were very uncertain as to, was the Fed going to continue to raise rates? Or are they going to become more accommodative as we went forward? And they were basically playing a barbell portfolio strategy. They had a growth component, and then they had this other component that was kind of an income component. And they were just kind of balancing between the two because they were not sure what was going to be the outcome based upon Fed and how accommodative they're ultimately going to be. But once you got into that September timeframe, the Fed came out and said, hey, we're going to be out providing more liquidity to the market. That certainly was the catalyst to watch a lot of those assets, Jim, that were in the safe haven sectors you had just mentioned, whether it was REITs or utilities, et cetera. That money started coming out of that area of the market and started going into more of the growth side. And then growth reinvigorated, and we saw large cap stocks even participate as more money came into that. So right now, Jim, where we are over and underweight with our work is we are still overweight tech, and it's been over 200 and change weeks that we've been overweight tech. We still think it's working. We're still overweight consumer cyclical. Spending is good. The relative strength trends still look very strong. And we had gotten overweight the industrial manufacturing sector several months ago, which again is now nicely working and we're seeing trends. This month, which in this month's publication, we did make one sector change, Jim. We did downgrade the utility sector itself, from neutral to underweight because the relative strength trends are rolling over. And we also did upgrade energy from an underweight back to a neutral. But we're seeing much more of a cyclical bend, growth bend to the market that's probably going to continue as we progress through 2020.
You upgraded energy to neutral. Let's talk about commodities. Where do you see commodities going this year? I mean, if we look at, we just got this trade deal announced on Wednesday. We've got copper shooting up. Energy shot up briefly, but has been coming down. Where do you see commodities playing out in all this?
Well, I think one of the great questions, very broad. Let me dig into this in a couple different ways of what I'm thinking about. One, when you look at the CRB index, it is trending a little bit higher as of late, but I would not say it's, you know, a massive trend change in the CRB index quite yet. It's something we're clearly watching. But the one thing that I just want to note with that CRB index, a big part of that CRB index is crude oil. And crude oil, to me, is this component of the commodities we've got to pay a lot of attention to. We've got more saber rattling happening in the Middle East at this point in time. We've seen a couple instances where oil has shot up in response to some of that, you know, pickup and saber rattling between the U.S. and Iran. If oil continues to stay where it's at and continues to consolidate kind of in this high 50s, low 60s range, I think the economy is going to be fine and continue to work. Copper picking up is certainly a positive sign for the overall economy. The only kind of disconnect I see in the commodity space right now, Jim, is really gold. Gold, to me, looks like it wants to go up towards 1770, maybe even 1800. And so that's a mixed message. And maybe that speaks to the higher political concerns coming up into the election. Perhaps it's also playing into the additional saber rattling in the Middle East at this point in time. But for me, oil, there's almost a zero correlation, believe it or not, right now between crude oil prices and the actual stocks themselves. These stocks look largely washed out, in my opinion, and I think there's an opportunity there for more of a value-oriented investor and a listener to this show that will be looking to want to put some money to work for the next, say, 12 to 24 months. I think you're going to see some interesting trends in energy.
I want to talk about something that makes this year different. It's a presidential election year. And Craig, going back to 2016, if you listen to the polls, it told us that Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And then on the night of the election, when it looked, you know, the Dow was down 800 points, they were predicting a crash if Trump got elected. The next day, the market went up and it's never looked back. This year, in contrast, there's a major viewpoint difference between obviously the Trump administration, President Trump, and the leading candidates on the Democratic side. I'm thinking of Sanders or Warren, who would get rid of fracking and some pretty radical ideas. What's your opinion if, let's say, one of these becomes the candidate? Does that have any impact on the market?
If I think about the election overall and then drill down into the candidates, but in any given election year, and I went back and I looked at the last 119 years for elections, Jim, and you've generated about an average return of a little over 7%. And you had positive returns 65% of the time. When you've had an incumbent Republican up for an election, you've actually seen the market higher 75% of the time with an average return of about 10.28%. Now, if we dissect the election we've got this year, Think about what we had in 2016. 2016, it was very, very clear that the American voter wanted change. The same dry, old policies, and they wanted something new. And at any price, Donald Trump was the answer. He was bringing growth as what he was going to bring. Now, some people don't like Mr. Trump from the aspect that they don't like his delivery mechanism of how he gets things done. Okay, I can appreciate that, and I respect all opinions. But Trump is pro-growth, good for the market. People are making money. You've got great returns. Now, if that agenda was to change with a Democrat coming back in with stale, old, I'm just simply going to tax people to pay for everything else, I don't think this market is going to continue to trade at the valuation that is trading at. And I think you would see a reset in equities. And I think that would be very painful for investors and for the American and for the public. I would like to see a continuation of the pro-growth policies going forward. And I think that would be best for investors.
So do you think we start running into, like, everybody that I've read or take a look at, and you've mentioned a lot of this in your forecast piece that you put out in December, there are a lot of things going right now. You mentioned a number of them. Unemployment, wages are rising, consumers are strong, the trade deal, accommodative Fed. And as I've looked at recessions over the last four or five decades, Craig, there's been three or four factors that have been there that have caused recessions. Tightening monetary policy, we don't have that. Spiking oil prices, we don't have that. Rising inflation, we don't have that. Or let's say an asset bubble, and I would say we don't have that. So all four of those are absent right now. I just don't see a recession.
Jim, I don't think I can sum it up any better than that. You're exactly right. Now, part of the reason I think gold's been going up and there is a little bit of this trepidation among investors, you got the saber rattling in the Middle East, and there's concerns you could get some form of a disruption in the oil supply coming in. Now, the U.S. is more insulated from that shock because we are producing more of our own crude oil here in the country today. But I would still tell you that if there was to be a situation where the Strait of Hormuz gets blocked for some reason, oil prices are going up, and that would probably be the oil shock scenario. That's not there today. But people are extrapolating things out, and I think they're taking things a little bit too far at this point in time. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, markets have largely brushed off a lot of the challenges that we've seen. When you had the missile just the other week, the market rebounded very quickly and got back to new highs because it was clear there was no damage. There was no change to the underlying infrastructure or supply demands, or I should say, supply stream of oil coming out of, you know, the Middle East. So I think the market's being pretty rational about this. There is no sign of a recession at this point.
So Craig, if we were to sum up, you're sticking with your 3,600 figure for the S&P 500. Your favorite sectors continue to remain tech, consumer cyclicals, industrials, and recently you've been upgrading energy. Would that be safe to say?
Jim, that is exactly correct. And I would also say that I look for 10-year bond yields to work a little bit higher as we progress through this year. And in fact, in our most recent publication, Jim, we've talked about 10-year bond yields working their way up to about 215, maybe even close to the 230 range, as we think that we will start to get rates to work their way higher. If I just draw as an example from the German Bund, the Bund has started to pick up, and I think that's going to be a positive catalyst for rates all around the world, because that had been the region where you had seen some of the lowest 10-year bond yields and sovereign debt yields. So again, rates a little bit higher, I'd add that in there too.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, as always, we wanted to have you on the show first as we began this year, especially with your figure of 3,600, which stands way above the others. And next time you're in San Diego, let's do Fogo de Chao.
Let's do it.
All right. Happy New Year, Craig. Thanks for coming on the program.
There are two major risks to the economy and the bull market in 2020. Right at the top of the list is the Fed and the 2020 political election. We tackle both of these subjects in an interview with Jim Bianco. He's the president and founder of Bianco Research on FS Insider. And Jim says that we are seeing an explosion of the Fed's balance sheet to the tune of $400 $6 billion that they have injected into the markets since last September, largely in response to the repo crisis. And that has a lot of similarities to what we saw during the tech bubble right around the time of the Y2K. So we discuss that. We also get his outlook and analysis on the 2020 political election. I would switch from Trump over to Biden or Bernie Sanders, what that would mean, types of surprises that that would lead to, and why that's another of the biggest risks that the market faces in 2020. Here's a clip of what Jim had to tell our listeners.
If Biden wins, you would also have to assume that the Democrat Party had done very well in the House and the Senate races as well, to maybe even take back the Senate. They're way left of center. They're talking about Green New Deal. They're talking about MMT. They voted on the Green New Deal. Biden is going to get his party pushing left of center agendas, and it's going to be next to impossible for him to stop it. He could try and water it down and he could try to massage it as much as he wants, but if his party is pushing these agendas, and I'm talking on the economic frontier, I think then what you would see happen is the markets would take that as an unsettling thing as well, too. Obviously, if Bernie became the president, it would be really take it unsettling because Bernie would be leading the charge instead of trying to blunt the charge. But the charge would come regardless of who the president is.
So if you want to hear this full interview with Jim Bianco, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, so far, a good start to 2020. Assets are doing well. We're going to be talking about commodities. Where are they going to be heading in this year? Joining us is Mike McClone. He's commodity strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Mike, let's begin with gold, which is off to a real good start, especially coming off what we saw last year.
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And December is typically one of the best months for gold. If you look at just the average for the last 5 years, this month, gold increased 5%. So I published on that, and I think it was one of the first weeks of the month. And then if that's the case, gold should get up to 1600. Now, we did for other reasons. Gold did touch 1600 because of the issues with Iran. But typically, this is the best time of month. But overall, I view gold as one of the highest probability commodities of continuing to increase in value this year.
What are some of the catalysts that are driving it? We know around this time of the year, you've got Indian wedding sales, you've got Christmas sales. And then usually by the time you get down to summer, gold tends to correct or remain stagnant. What are the drivers in your opinion?
It's important, but I think most of that is basically kind of noise in the big picture macro sense. To me, that's what really drives the dollar value of gold. So first, let's look at the examples. Gold, in terms of the euro, the euro currency has already made a new high. It did last year. In terms of the British pound, it's made a new high. To the Canadian loonie, it's made a new high. And some of the lesser traded currencies, like the Indian rupee, has made a new high. So to me, it's just a matter of time that it does it in the dollar, because I think one way to remember gold, it's almost always about the value, or it's the neutral adult versus most other currencies. And the key issue that's been really driving it, and I think it's should continue to drive it, is this pretty substantial decline in interest rates globally. A lot of people look at real rates. I just look at, you know, in this case, it's overall rates. So look at the 10-year yield right now. It's about 179. A year ago, it was 2 and change. That trend remains down. And also another significant thing that really kicked gold in last year was when the Fed first started to ease. Remember, one thing to point out is the gold market bottomed in December 2015 when the Fed first started tightening. Remember, that was the first tightening cycle. So gold was looking ahead. Mm-hmm. So to me, now it's looking ahead to the next phase. And the big drivers, I think, it would be at some point if we get a decrease in the value of the dollar. But gold's already telling us dollar is basically declining already. It's just not doing it versus other currencies. So the gold dollar ratio rate is going up. But the biggest thing also will be the U.S. stock market. So I think we're at an inflection point where the next big catalyst for gold to go higher will be when the U.S. stock market stops this record pace.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that a lot of us in the U.S. tend to forget. We look at gold in terms of U.S. dollars. But if you look at gold, as you just mentioned, Mike, in other currencies, whether it's the euro, the yen, or other currencies, it's been hitting record levels.
Yeah, it is. So to me, it's just a matter of time. And what's the main issue? So because those currencies are not doing as well. But one thing we all know is currencies are pieces of paper, and there's unlimited supply, versus that's the main benefit of gold versus virtually any other commodity or quasi-currency in the world or on the planet. The supply is limited. It's historically, it's never really increased much more than 2% on average. And that's why it continues to appreciate in value. And it always should, most notably versus other commodities like copper, where you can increase supply easily, or crude oil, which we know we grow now. And, you know, being from the Midwest, we create a lot of petroleum from corn.
So if we look at gold, and as you mentioned, on the night of the attacks of the missiles, gold briefly hit over 1600. You can see gold heading to 16 higher this year. Does it go beyond that? In other words, could we once again, Mike, approach the previous records that were reached in 2011?
Yeah, we will. That's just a question of time. And I have to caveat that as I expect to see that in my lifetime, and I'm not that old yet. But to me, the risk is it does sooner than most people expect. And my fear is it does. And the primary catalyst is, let's first put it this way, gold right now is simply retracing a bear market. It's nothing new or special. And the big bear market was 2017. That high was about 1700. So to me, that's the next big resistance. Obviously, we have 1600 to play with now and this year. So it's basically 1500 to 1600 are the key support and resistance levels. And then, you know, the fundamentals are what is going to make it go higher. And that, to me, the bottom line is at some point when the U.S. stock market volatility, I should say, the VIX index starts inching higher or continues to inch higher, that would be a major, to me, catalyst for launching the price of gold. So it's a pretty positive correlation with volatility. And right now, volatility is very low. The VIX is quite low. It's running around, 12% or so. And the historic mean is 19%. So at some point, we should get back there.
Let's move on to sort of another commodity tied to the global markets, often associated with gold, at least in the mining business. That's copper. At least right now, copper's looking pretty good. What's your view?
It is, but one thing people need to remember about copper, it's on the short term, it looks good, but it's still the big difference, let's put it technically, it's well within last year's range. Last year's high was about $3 a pound, and last year's low was 2.5, and it's trading right around 280, 290. And gold's already breaking out above last year's high, but the key thing to remember about copper is it's been in a bear market for 10 years. It peaked in 2011, and that's right about the time China GDP at the time was around 10%. China GDP and copper have been both declining since. Should be less than 6% next year. That's China GDP, and that trend is clearly down. That's the key demand side for copper, and the key supply side for copper is from Chile. One thing that's a good indicator of supply from Chile is the value of the Chilean peso. Guess what? It's near all-time new lows versus the dollar. So I see enduring trends in copper that are negative, and I fear that we're seeing a little bit too much optimism at the beginning of this year. So let me caveat that versus the beginning of last year, the right thing to do was breakout buy tickets in things like gold. And not so much gold at the minute, but crude oil, stock market, and copper, because they all were so depressed. Now we have so much optimism in the stock market and optimism for a new and great trade deal that's going to increase the, you know, global demand for copper, that I'm very fearful that this more enduring bear market trend is more likely to sustain itself. And copper was really precedent in 2018. It peaked in August and it declined over 20%. By the end of August, well before the stock market started its first 20% correction in 7 years in 2018.
So what about some of the fundamentals, putting aside China's growth in its economy, which has been slowing down? I'm talking about, for example, the electrification of the transportation system. So if we move more and more towards electric cars, which require more copper, what about that fundamental?
That's bullish for copper. So that is a good thing, and I'm glad you brought that up. So this, I like to really differentiate the two most significant industrial commodities. The most significant in the world is crude oil, and copper is a little bit more, you know, known as the PhD with a degree in economics. The big difference is what you mentioned. There's a good chance for a long-term recovery in copper prices because of rapidly advancing technology and demand and, you know, ESG investing and decarbonization. That really favors things like copper and cobalt and other metals, but it's really not favorable for crude oil. The thing for me for copper is in the short, EVs are, and that's just a longer term, you got to look out 10 years really for that to really matter. In the shorter term year or two, it's really more global economic demand in GDP growth, and that's more China, and that's, I think there's just too much optimism that this centrally planned economy that has not had free flow of information or free flow of capital is just going to bounce back. I think what's happening in China is my relation to copper similar to what happened with the peak in Japan and the peak in the Soviet Union about 30 years ago. Once the U.S. put the kibosh on their exports, which the U.S. has done with China, then that's what peaked the Japanese miracle 30 years ago. So I'm fearful that's what's happening in China. But overall, you're right. The massive shift towards EVs and is very good for the price of copper. Just that's a little longer term.
All right, let's move on to oil. It spiked briefly with the conflict in the Middle East. What really surprises me, if we go back to, what was it, last September, when there was a strike against a major Saudi oil facility, oil spiked for a couple days or two, and then it was back below that. Same thing this time around. I think the spike lasted about 24 hours, if less. So what's your view on oil?
Exactly. What you mentioned and noted were failed spikes. That is indicative of a bear market. And the primary reason is massive U.S. supply, which is a delight from those of us who grew up in the 70s. And I remember pumping gas when it went over $1 a gallon. And that is just what's happening. And it's also a lack of demand. So I see the main way to describe crude oil is oversupplied. And the only way to really get it to go higher, I see, is we need sustained cuts from OPEC, which is fleeting. Because you know what happens with that, it just makes prices go higher and brings in more supply from non-OPEC producers, i.e. U.S. and other companies, countries like Brazil and et cetera. But also, we're using so much less. So one significant statistic is you look at the amount of liquid fuels or crude oil consumed in this country, it is flat over a 20-year basis. It's basically not up. Now it's up in the last few years, but that's like never happened in history. A lot of that is efficiency and more efficient electric vehicles and things like that. Yet our production in this country is up almost 100% over the same time frame. Those trends are enduring, in my view. And I for one, drive an electric car. I love it. And I don't sense people going back. And just put that out, bigger picture, long term, it's not good for the price of crude oil. It's becoming more like whale oil. I mean, it's not there yet, but and also this substantial trend towards ESG investing and decarbonization, and a lot of, especially in California and stuff, limiting the carbon and stuff. I see crude oil, big picture bearish and even shorter term bearish. So I don't know what it's going to take except some form of unpredictable thing like a war or something that would really reduce supply.
Okay, let me throw a sort of curve out and let's talk about politics. Some of the leading candidates on the Democratic side said they would ban fracking in this country. And we all know that if it wasn't for fracking, the U.S. wouldn't be producing more than 12 million barrels a day. What if something like that happened?
Well, this is part of my theory that making America great is bad for commodity prices. And that would obviously be, I think, bad for the overall country and would be good for the price of oil and would hurt your average consumer. It's basically adding a tax to your average consumer. It's basically taking what U.S. has done to revolutionize this space and the dream that we had back when Jimmy Carter was president and those of us had to turn down the heat and put on sweaters. That dream has been reached and it's basically taking that dream and throwing it out the window. That's the way I see it. I think just the natural progression of technology is going to eliminate the need in the long term. But to me, this is it would be quite a sad case if that happened. But, what are you going to do? It's just part of life. You have to deal with these type of risks. But to me, we've reached that dream that people like, President Jimmy Carter was and those of us who lived through the energy crisis had many years ago.
Okay, final look at commodities. What about ags this year?
That's the one sector I actually think there's good chance to go higher. And the bottom line is in commodities, we often say lower prices are the cure for lower prices. That's a key space for there. So if we talk about ags, a key place you really have to narrow down to is the grain. So corn, soybeans, and wheat. That's in terms of like the Bloomberg Agriculture Index, that's 3/4 of the index. And that's the vast majority of all ags in terms of dollar value in the world. The bottom line is the ags need more demand globally and more exports. And that might happen with China. We hope that comes back. But China is not stupid. They're not going to buy more expensive soybeans from the U.S. when they can get it cheap in Brazil. And that's the bottom line is the value of the U.S. dollar. It's virtually near all-time highs on a trade-weighted basis, trade-weighted with U.S. trade partners. And until the dollar peaks and goes down, it's unlikely ag prices are going to have substantial upside. They need some form of weather event, which are usually shorter term. But, my overall supply demand indicators are prices, are just waiting to go higher once the dollar can peak. And the problem is for the dollar to peak. Typically, in this case, we probably need the U.S. stock market to start showing some relative weakness. And that's been one of the primary companions of a strong dollar, which has been, you know, near all-time highs, is the U.S. stock market outperforming the world. And guess what's driving the U.S. stock market? Most notably technology, as you know. So it's kind of a unique conundrum that ags will go up, usually most likely when stocks go down, because it means the dollar go down. But that's where they kind of are stuck. In the shorter term, we have to deal with things like the Brazilian real and potential for more exports. And the one thing, this is another thing, like our energy, the U.S. being great again, we are just, the U.S. is this massive increase in U.S. grain production, which is where I'm from, Illinois, is historic. And it's even during last year's challenging year, we still had a massive crop. It's just this amount of supply is tremendous. It's U.S. energy and agriculture food supply is just historic. Things we've dreamed of years ago. And most notably, a lot of that's on the back of good old American technology.
Well, fantastic. So, Mike, if we were to sum up, your highest degree of confidence in the commodity space for 2020 would be gold.
Unfortunately, yes. As a commodity guy, you always want to be bullish and you want to buy things. And I, unfortunately, oftentimes when gold goes up, it means it's not so good for other things. But I have to stick with the fundamentals and the facts and the technicals, and they start quite favorable for good old gold.
All right. Well, listen, Mike, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do at Bloomberg, how could they do so?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there in Bloomberg. Of course, Bloomberg Terminal. A lot of our stuff is on the Bloomberg website. But for me, and you can find me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to add people to my distribution list if they contact me. LinkedIn's a good way to do it.
All right, Mike. Well, listen, thanks so much, and Happy New Year to you.
And thank you.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
In today's Big Picture, we're going to follow up with our discussion from last week where we looked at the consensus forecast for 2020. Well, today we're going to get into our own view. Title of today's Big Picture is Forecast 2020, The Next Big Thing, Gold, Copper, Oil, and Elections. Jim, why don't you kick things off starting with what you're looking at the U.S. economy in terms of the risk of a recession this year?
Well, Chris, if we take a look at every single recession going back to World War II, there have normally been four characteristics that bring a recession. The main one is Fed monetary policy. Basically, the economy would heat up, you would have inflation, the Fed would raise rates, they'd kill the economy, we'd go in a recession, then they would loosen interest rates to bring us out. So aggressive monetary policy, that was a risk that everyone was talking about going into 2019 after four rate hikes in 2018. But we all know that the Fed did a pivot. They did a 180. So let's check that off the list. The second thing that is associated with recessions have been huge oil spikes. Think of the big major recession in 1974 with the oil embargo, the overthrow of the Shah in 1979, and 1981 when the price of oil spiked all the way to $40. Fast forward to the recession of 91, a spike in oil with the Gulf War. Fast forward to 2001, price of oil tripled, actually went from about 10 to about 35. And then fast forward to our last recession, which started in 2007, as the price of oil went all the way up to $150. Well, today we're below 60, so we don't have that. Inflation, it's muted. It's under 2%. You know, the Fed has had a hard time reaching its inflation goals. And then finally, the fourth factor, which would be asset bubbles. Can you say stocks are cheap? Absolutely not. The PE ratio on stocks, whether you're looking at it over a longer period of time, is at an elevated level. But can you say the market isn't a bubble as real estate was before the last recession or tech stocks going into 2000? No. Prices are elevated. but it's not an asset bubble. So, Chris, there is no reason we have to have a recession. And it's usually caused by one of these four factors, primarily Fed policy and oil spikes. And we just don't have that today. The economy is growing, you know, albeit it's not growing at the rate that we're used to, at a 3% rate. Maybe it's going to be 2%. I think we could see some upside surprise on that. But anyway, those factors are absent right now, so I just don't see a recession.
Yeah, Jim, as you're pointing out with aggressive monetary policy, I mean, if you think about it, the Fed was reducing their balance sheet through all of 2018 and then through most of 2019. And during that time, the S&P 500 U.S. stocks were basically in a very large trading range. And we've seen now stocks break out. We're seeing Google at a $1 trillion market cap. We're hitting all-time record highs on a daily basis. And the Fed is expanding their balance sheet by the quickest pace that we've seen since 2008. So the Fed is providing that tailwind. And people are now, there was an article in Bloomberg I was looking at, where people are now shifting the narrative from, it definitely looks now at this point that they're engaged in quantitative easing. Powell's remarks of this not being QE is kind of now being dismissed, and people are now saying this looks like quantitative easing, especially when you look at what's happening in the market.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because if you look at the stock market last year, it was more of a risk-off trade with the exception of technology. And then take a look at the stock market from the middle of September going forward to the present time period. As the Fed in September jumped into the repo market, then they announced they were going to be pumping $60 billion a month into the market until the second quarter of this year, roughly about $600 billion. That liquidity infusion coming into the market, you could lay that right over a chart of the stock market and they line up right on top of each other. So you're right. But if we look at the economy right now, the lowest unemployment that we've had in over half a century, rising wages, easy monetary policy, QE4. We just saw easing of trade tensions, lower borrowing rates, which are improving or helping the housing market. And what's driving this isn't, at least at this point, isn't business investment. It's consumer spending. It's government spending. And we're also seeing improving LEIs both here and abroad. So at least if you look at most typical bear markets, Chris, they've been caused or been preceded by a recession, Fed tightening. Those things don't exist. And at least right now, I've never seen a bear market without a recession. So, you know, we may have what we call mini bear markets. Some would argue the 20% correction in the fourth quarter of 2018 was a mini bear market, but a major cyclical secular bear market, I just don't see it.
Yeah, Jim Bianco on FS Insider this week, he said that the two biggest risks he saw to the market in 2020 would be one, U.S. elections, which we talked about last week, and we'll get into that this week as well, of course, later on in the program. But then the other one is if the Fed were to decide to reverse course, because we are seeing them expand their balance sheet $60 billion per month, a very fast pace. To him, it almost looks similar to what we saw during the tech bubble when the Fed was expanding liquidity as well. So to him, that's a pretty big risk. They're expanding so quickly that if they decide to pull that spigot in reverse course, that could cause a problem. But at this point, they're not doing that. And if you look at the central bank outlook, according to research, there's no expectations for central banks to be raising rates in 2020. If anything, most are either expected to lower or stay the same. So at this point, the central bank outlook is favorable for the market.
And then also, let's take a look at the technical backdrop. As Craig Johnson was talking about earlier in the show, we're back to a TINA market. There is no alternative. I mean, you're taking a look at Treasury yields at 1.8% on a 10-year note. Chris, in our income fund, we're getting dividend yields of 5 and 6% on blue chips stocks. So it's not just here in the U.S., but it's globally. People may think interest rates are low here, but in Europe, they're negative, and in Japan, they're negative. So where are you going to get a rate of return if you're an institution, or for that matter, a central bank, or just high net worth investors? Where do you get returns today? Think of all the people heading into retirement that need to live on assets to support their retirement. Where are they going to get income? Some of the best yields I can find are in the stock market. As you just mentioned, throw in the liquidity. And also the other reason these markets are going higher, why you mentioned Google is now has a $1 trillion market cap. I think Apple's is 1.4 trillion. The amount of money that's flowing into index funds, Apple's now about 5% of the S&P. So every dollar that goes into the S&P index, 5% of it is going into Apple. So you're going to see these stocks. It's no secret why we're seeing Apple. What, it's 316 now. It was up over 80% last year, and it's up 4 or 5% already this year.
Yeah, the four companies, Apple, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, their combined market capitalization accounts for 15% of the weight of the S&P 500. And so that's something that I know some strategists are looking at as a risk that, hey, it looks like we're getting a little bit too concentrated in the tech sector, similar to what we saw during the tech bubble. As of now, these stocks going up, it's great. I mean, for the people that hold these in their portfolio, they like to see that. But when you think about market concentration, that's not too healthy. So I think one thing we should be keeping on our radar when you have these big top four companies having so much of an influence on the broad indices.
We did a show a couple of years ago and I identified one of the, if there is a bubble, it's in index funds. Because a couple of years ago, we were looking at the valuation of some of these companies, whether it was Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, less so Apple or Facebook. And I was trying to say to myself, who is buying these companies at these multiples? And when we did our research through our Bloomberg, we took a look at the top 10 ownership. It was all index funds. And so if you want to look at a bubble, and I'm sure later on in the year, we'll be talking about this once again, the bubble is in index funds, just as that's driving the price of Apple, Alphabet, all these big cap stocks in the S&P that make up about 15% of the index. On the downside, it works just in reverse. But right now, it's still positive.
And we'll have a link out to that podcast if any of you want to listen to it. I would highly recommend it because we go through some very compelling research on what's driving this bubble higher and what it means for the future. So everyone should definitely listen to that if you haven't already. Jim, going back to the subject of today's podcast, it's our view, Forecast 2020. Tell us about stock market returns. What are you expecting for this year?
You know, Chris, I think you're going to have to break up 2020 into two segments. The first half of the year, which is going to be positive economic growth, market returns, and then the second half of the year. In the second half of the year, you're going to have to break it up into quarters. Because I think when we get to the summer in the third quarter, as we will have a candidate on the Democratic side for president, I think you're going to see a lot more volatility. And we'll get into some of the risks to the markets based on a different outcome come November. But I think third quarter gets to be more volatile. A couple things happen. Number one, at the end of June, just like when the Fed was first announcing QE1 and QE2, they said, we're going to be adding this liquidity to the market. And we're going to do this all the way up to the second quarter of this year. Well, what happens when they stop at the end of June? Does liquidity dry up? And do we find ourselves in a situation like we did in 2018? That's number one. Number two is the risk on the presidential side, because I have never seen so opposing forces in philosophy as in this election year. You're talking about capitalism versus socialism. And I think that's going to start creating a lot of nervousness in the market. So I expect the third quarter volatility to increase, and especially if the Fed pulls back and ends its liquidity injections. And then people will be focused on politics. As Jim Bianco said, one of the big risks to this market this year is going to be the election. Then after the election is over, depending on the outcome, if Trump gets reelected, then I would expect a favorable finish to the end of the year. If he does not get reelected, I expect a bear market in a recession.
I mean, yeah, you think about, let's just hypothetically say Elizabeth Warren were to win. She's been a very outspoken opponent against the big companies, against monopolies. So if she were to take on these big four tech companies that, again, as we said, are now 15% of market capitalization in the broad indices, if she were to take them on as the next president, I mean, that is going to have major repercussions for the market, given their size. So, I mean, these are some of the risks that I think we have to keep in mind, regardless of where you stand politically. The effects on investors are clear. There's a clear and present danger, let's just say.
Absolutely. And also, they would ban fracking. And one of the reasons that we have not had these big spikes in oil, we saw a brief spike when the missile attack on Saudi oil facilities, and we saw it again with the missile strikes. But Chris, they're fleeting. They're ephemeral. They don't last more than a day or maybe a week. And part of that is because of fracking in U.S. production. I mean, we're producing what? 12.6 million barrels a day. The U.S. has been one of the major factors in the energy market and one of the reasons we all as consumers enjoy lower energy prices. Well, what happens when you ban fracking? New York banned fracking. It's not doing as well as Pennsylvania. California just banned fracking here in California with the new governor. And so oil production is declining here in California. So that could have some major consequences, but, you know, we'll talk about that in just a moment.
So, Jim, as you were talking about, you know, some of the election risks that we could be seeing in 2020, of course, we do want to point out that investors, the market is anticipatory. So even prior to understanding what the outcome is, just the investor anxiety or uncertainty alone will probably have an impact on the market well before the November 2020 election. But let's talk about some of these wild cards that you have on your radar for this year.
The two, I would agree with Jim Bianco. The two would be, I would have some concern at the end of June if the Fed said, you know what, we've injected it enough. In fact, we may just maybe cut back on the balance sheet a little bit. There was a Fed governor that came out this week that said he was worried that they were putting too much liquidity in the market and citing the almost meteoric rise in stock prices. So that's one. And then the second one is geopolitical risk. That's always out there in the Middle East. Just take a look at the way we started this year with missile attacks. We took out Iran's general. I remember when that was happening, I was on my treadmill watching the news, and oh my God, Chris, they thought that, you know, they were talking about we had sent 8 B-52 bombers in there. We had carrier battle groups. The president was going to address the nation. I mean, it was very tense for a couple hours, and obviously it de-escalated. So you always have that. I think the biggest risk is on the political front, because normally there's a little bit of difference between both parties, but I can't think of a major difference this year in terms of the candidates. The front runners, Bernie Sanders is raising a lot of money, Elizabeth Warren. The irony of this, Bernie Sanders and Warren don't think we should have billionaires or tax the hell out of them. And yet, on the Democratic side, you got two billionaires. You've got Tom Steyer and you got Michael Bloomberg, who said he's willing to spend up to $1 billion of his own personal fortune on this election. So you've got both candidates want higher taxes. They would repeal the Trump tax cuts. Sanders would raise tax rates. Warren would have an annual wealth tax. I don't know how you do that. Then you have the Green New Deal, which would phase out cars, planes, and beef. Warren wants government control of corporate decision making. And also both candidates would ban fracking. So if we get to the summer and either of these candidates becomes the nominee, and then, of course, they're going to have a platform, just like the Republicans will. They'll say, hey, if we're elected, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to break up the tech companies. We're going to raise wealth taxes. We're going to do all these things. Then the market's going to start paying a lot more attention to the election politics. We'll be following polls. And the tricky thing about this, and what is so unpredictable, Chris, is if you look at the 2016 elections, if you looked at the polls, including the exit polls on the day of the election, it would have said Hillary Clinton was going to be president. Well, it turned out Donald Trump was president. So I don't think you can even rely in this age of political correctness. I don't think people tell the polls correctly in terms of what they're going to do in the ballot booth. So this is going to be a very unpredictable election, in my opinion, and that's going to have some bearing on the stock market.
I mean, Jim, could you just imagine if they were to ban fracking, what that would do?
Oh, I mean, then you would see oil spikes. If you did have tension in the Middle East, I mean, that would take out a good portion of U.S. production in the U.S. I mean, the reason we're producing over 12 million barrels today versus 5 going back to 2008 is because of fracking. So, and that's why anytime you have some kind of out of the blue rogue wave event that occurs in the Middle East, it doesn't last long. You know, oil may spike briefly, as gold did on the day of the missile attack, but the following day it was pulling back. It dropped 10%. We're below $60 a barrel today. If you were to cut off U.S. production, that wouldn't be the case.
And as you were saying earlier, you know, when we think about what's likely to happen in 2020, at this point, it doesn't look like the odds of recession are very high because we have the central bank providing liquidity. There isn't an oil spike. We saw very brief temporary oil spikes after some of the geopolitical disturbances that have happened so far. But ample oil supplies have brought oil prices back down. So those are two things off the list, which again means that low probability recession in 2020. And so let's talk about investment strategy. What is it that we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management with clients based on some of the things that we've discussed so far?
We began last year moving into commodities, especially gold, oil, international markets, and of course, high dividend-paying stocks. If you look at the markets around the globe, some of the best values are in overseas markets, whether you're looking at Europe or Asia. And so we've moved into the international space, and that's working out well for us. We're also in commodities, Chris, especially gold. We just increased it once again, our gold position. And then we're also in high dividend paying stocks. In our income account, as I mentioned, we've got, what, 7 stocks that are paying 5% or more. And these are blue chip companies. I mean, where are you going to get 5% in a market where you have negative interest rates? The Fed has cut rates. Money market fund yields are down next to nothing. So we favor dividend-paying stocks outside of utilities, international markets, and we're moving into commodities. We just did more in oil and agriculture, and we like that space.
Now, when you're talking about getting back into the gold market last year, this is a pretty significant move because, as I understand it, we have been out of precious metals for around 7 years. And I know that you were making a big call on precious metals, gold and silver, back in the early 2000s when you wrote your Next Big Thing piece that went viral. And many of our longtime listeners will know the history of some of these major calls that you've made on gold, silver, commodities, and the like, including oil as well. So this is a pretty significant shift, it sounds like.
Well, it is. And, you know, in this high-tech world that we live in, we're talking about electric vehicles, clean energy. Chris, this is still going to be a carbon world for the next decade. You know, you're the 787 Dreamliner that you're going to get on is going to be run on jet fuel. The goods that are going to be coming to the ports of New York and Los Angeles are going to be coming to the ports on ships that run on diesel fuel, although there was a big change in sulfur content that went into effect this year. The other thing is you take a look at going into clean energy. I don't care if it's solar panels or it's electric vehicles. It's these kind of technologies use copper. I think I was reading there's like 130 pounds of copper that goes into a Tesla. And most people don't realize this, but we're running about 200,000 ton deficits per year in copper. And that's only going to get bigger moving forward. Just as we were talking with Bloomberg on this, longer term, you know, we love copper and we love gold. The other thing that I think that brings this all into play is right now, we're running trillion-dollar deficits with the lowest unemployment in a half a century, the economy growing at 2% a year, and we're running trillion-dollar deficits. You get into the next decade, you've got, I think it's by the year 2025, which is the largest contingent of baby boomers that are going to hit the market. That's going to put further strains on Social Security and Medicare. And God forbid we get into a recession, you could see deficits, Chris, that are close to $2 trillion. And the policy experts and the politicians know this is coming, and that's why they're throwing out MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, which basically says, look, if you're printing or issuing debt in your own currency, there is no limits to what you can do. And there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this week by Greg Ipp, and it's called "The Era of Fed Power is Over. Prepare for a More Perilous Road Ahead." And it's basically saying the efficacy of QE and lowering rates. I mean, the Fed isn't starting this cycle with a 5% Fed funds rate or a 5.5. They only got to 2.5 before they had to start cutting again. So what do they do when they get another economic downturn? They talk about fiscal policy or massive government spending, which gets simply monetized by the Fed. And believe me, if the government and the Fed wants to create creation, they can do that. And the best example I can give you is going back to 1933 in the depths of the Great Depression. We were in true deflation, and when Roosevelt came into power, the first thing he did is devalue the dollar. He stopped deflation overnight. The month they did it, they start experiencing inflation. The markets start taking off. So if the government wants to generate inflation, they really can. And I think that's something that we're going to see more and more of and be talking more about in the next decade. And I think that's a favorable environment for gold, precious metals, hard assets. Look at it this way. What do you think central banks are doing now? The biggest buyers of gold globally are central banks.
That's right. Yeah, we're seeing massive purchases by central banks, particularly in China and India and that part of the world, Russia as well is included in those. I mean, they're buying gold hand over fist. And it's interesting, Jim, because when you're talking about modern monetary theory and how this relates to what we're going to see going forward, not just in the United States, but around the world, this idea that governments can print money as long as they create their own currency. If they are a reserve currency, that would include Japan, that would include the U.S., and perhaps even the European Central Bank as well, although there are some slight differences there. But this idea that they can print money and not have to suffer the consequences of inflation, right? And if we hearken back to what we saw post-2008, there were a lot of people worried about hyperinflation. We didn't see that materialize. So now the modern monetary theorists are saying, hey, government can print money. We don't have to worry about inflation. It's non-existent. And if inflation rears its ugly head, all we have to do is raise taxes by whatever amount to bring inflation into line. And so that's the fear. And I've got to say, we had a fascinating interview with Martin Armstrong this week on FS Insider talking about his new book, where he shows how modern monetary theory is really the last hurrah of government's attempt to try to control and regulate the business cycle, that this will be the final last-ditch effort that they'll implement. And he thinks that it's ultimately going to lead to a tax revolt and possibly even another American Revolution. That's not something that's going to be happening tomorrow anytime soon, but these are some of the things that he's got on his radar that'll be happening in the years ahead. So that was a fascinating interview. If any of you haven't listened to that or aren't subscribers, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
You know, it's amazing, Chris. I began my career at the end of 1979, 1980. Inflation was running at 14%. Interest rates were on their way to 18%. Heck, treasuries were at 15.5%. And it was taxes and inflation. Those two themes are something I'm going to be articulating going into this new decade. Those are the two things that you're going to face. I mean, a good example is our own state of California. I mean, they're basically going when it comes to taxes. Not only do we have the highest taxes in the country, they just proposed this week that they are going to be taxing CEOs if they make a disproportionate amount of income over the employees of the firm. They cited Eisner at Disney. They cited Tim Cook at Apple. They're also basically, every time you turn on the television, those politicians in Sacramento are looking for a new tax. And I think at some point, the middle class and people, I believe Martin Armstrong is going to be right. We're going to have a revolt. They got a new measure they just put on the ballot. They just did away with Prop 13, if it's voted at the ballot, where they can start taxing commercial and industrial properties at market value instead of limiting the amount of increase. I mean, we are just going crazy here when it comes to taxes. And, you know, they banned fracking. Now Chevron is saying they may leave the state of California. We've lost Bank of America. We've lost Wells Fargo. We've lost Toyota. We've lost Nestle. You know, this is just nuts. It is absolutely nuts. And there is a limit to what people are willing to pay.
So in summary, Jim, the outlook for a recession in 2020 is low as long as the Fed remains loose and on the accommodative side, as they have been. One of the big things that we're going to have to look at is what happens in June when they step away from their $60 billion a month purchases. And of course, there's the big wild card for elections this year with a big potential switchover from Trump to another candidate that will have major ramifications for the market for oil. So that is going to be a big thing that many people are going to watch. And for that reason, you said the first half and the second half could be two different stories. So investors are going to need to be nimble, think about sector rotation and some potential volatility as we get to the second half of the year. And as far as the investment strategy implications and what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management for clients, we are still favoring blue chip dividend paying stocks in a world of very low to zero or negative interest rates. We've been accumulating positions in gold and gold stocks since last year, while also increasing our allocations to emerging market international stocks and commodities. Last but not least, if you'd like to contact us about our investment outlook or to inquire about our investment services, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us or give us a call at 888-486-3939. Once again, that number is 888-486-3939. 3939.
Yeah, I would say if you take a look at 2020, it's going to be a first half, second half scenario. The first half looks pretty good to us, whether it's the market or the economy. The third quarter, I think, is going to be volatile and perilous. And then depending on the outcome of the election, the fourth quarter. So you're going to have a nice run here in the first half. We don't see a lot of risk there. But as we get into the third and fourth quarter, watch out. things could change rapidly. That reflects our own views for 2020. On behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company's mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the